KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for joining me today on the show. Today, I'm very excited to have a repeat guest back, repeat guest number two, Professor Henry Chesbrough from the Haas School of Business at Berkeley, who I had on the show last year discussing his book, Open Innovation. And I'm very excited to have on the author of the follow-up to the book, Open Business Models. Professor Chesbrough, as I mentioned, is an adjunct professor at the Haas School of Business and executive director of the Center for Open Innovation, also at Haas. His previous book, about which we discussed last year, Open Innovation, was named one of the best business books of 2003 on NPR's All Things Considered. And in this book, Henry takes a deeper look at some of the intellectual property issues as well as some of the practical applications of his theory. Open Innovation, which we'll do a very short refresher on at the beginning of the show, basically focuses on the idea of sharing information and otherwise collaborating outside of your corporate structure in an effort to innovate and indeed to bring products to market. And that is a topic which is of particular interest, I think, to intellectual property people as well as technologists throughout the world because of the very pitched battles that are occurring right now in the space of intellectual property, and particularly whether those rights should be stronger or whether they should be weaker, and indeed what rights we ultimately need to incentivize creation. And in Open Business Models, the subtitle of the book points us in the direction of what the interview will be today. The subtitle is How to Thrive in the New Innovation Landscape. And so in this book, Henry takes more of a how-to approach, although there's plenty of theory and practical application as well, at how a business can go ahead and implement this model. And perhaps what I'll do is before we start the interview, I wanted to kind of read a paragraph from the book, which kind of contextualizes the conversation. And while I won't expect that anyone will have done the preparation of listening to Henry's previous interview with me on Hearsay Culture, I will encourage you to listen to that interview if you missed it by going to the podcast page for Hearsay Culture, which you can find at hearsayculture.com or through iTunes, through the Center for Internet Society, or through the CIS webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. But here's the quote that I'll read, and then we'll go to a short music break and start the conversation. On page 131 of the book, under heading Towards a World of Open Business Models, Henry writes, "In the open innovation model, it is the firm's business model that drives its search for innovation activities from internal or external sources. Firms must search for useful technologies that can advance their business model from whatever sources can provide the appropriate opportunities at the right time. They should be much more open about sharing or licensing technologies that don't fit with their business model but might work well in another company's model. They should then construct open business models to sustain these advances." And in that theory, the questions become, where are the tensions and where are some of the problems theoretically that Henry identified?
Well, if I've done my job properly, at the other end of the line is Henry. Henry, are you there?
Yes, I am, David. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for joining me again on Hearsay Culture. I appreciate you taking the time to come on and discuss your new book.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Let's start right off with, I read in the beginning a portion of page 131, but I think the logical first question is really as background, what do you mean by open innovation and how does this work build on the core of your first book?
Sure. Open innovation, in a nutshell, is the idea that good ideas are everywhere and that no company has a monopoly on useful information. So this means that companies need to make much greater use of external ideas and technology in their own business and often have internal ideas that aren't being used in their own business. These should be made available for others to use in their business.
The idea of open innovation, and we discussed this in detail on the last show, and so I don't want to recover old ground, but the core idea of sharing is one, and to put it broadly, is one that takes a lot of people, I think, by surprise. And maybe, again, for the benefit of the listeners, what was the core thesis or point that you were trying to bring home to the reader in open innovation?
Well, I think the core point was that businesses have to differentiate themselves, and then they have to sustain the differentiation. And it turns out that sharing is a powerful engine to create new combinations of ideas and technologies that create new value. So that's part of the differentiation. Then you have to sustain this. And in order to sustain this, businesses have to capture a piece of value somewhere in the process so they can reinvest and do it again in the future. So those two portions, creating value and capturing a piece of value, are the function of the firm's business model. So in the first book, the business model was relatively fixed. In the new book, Open Business Models, the business model itself becomes subject to experimentation and innovation to open it up, make it more dynamic, and find new ways to both create value and new ways to capture a portion of the value.
The Open Innovation came out in 2003, and now you're focusing on a business modeling aspect of it a few years later. And before we get into the core of the book and delve into some of the points that you raise, I'm curious, over the intervening, let's say, two or three years since these books were published, and obviously I'm assuming that Open Business Models is a book that you started on probably during the same time, if not immediately after Open Innovation came out. What changes, if any, have you seen in the landscape as a result of identifying and pursuing the Open Innovation model?
You're right that I began thinking about Open Business Models not long after the first book came out. One of the things that happened is I started describing the ideas in the first book to a number of different audiences. And one discussion I had was with a group of intellectual property attorneys. And one of the things that they mentioned when they heard this is, gee, if we're bringing lots of ideas from outside into the company and letting unused internal ideas go to the outside, you've got big intellectual property issues both coming in and going out.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognized after they said this that, boy, that's right, so I better take this intellectual property stuff more seriously. At the same time, as you mentioned in your introduction, there's a lot of active debate right now about policy toward intellectual property. And what I thought was perhaps missing in some of that was a perspective from inside companies and the management of intellectual property, connecting that directly to the innovation process in a company. So in this new book about open business models, I try to link directly the innovation process, which needs to become more open,
mm-hmm.
with the IP management process.
And I think, you know, it suggests an interesting trend, which I guess I'll ask you about before we get into the book, which is, you know, a lot of times, especially in any field, you have a certain amount of echo chambers and people not talking to each other across fields. And intellectual property law in particular, I recognize that you're not a lawyer, but intellectual property law has become so prominent now in management of firm assets as opposed to 20 or 30 years ago, as you point out in your book, that it seems to me that there needs to be more discussion between, and I'm not talking about internally at a firm where a firm would have in-house counsel or hire law firms to analyze its intellectual property assets and rights therefore, but I'm thinking more in terms of the scholarship, that there needs to be, in my estimation, much more discussion between the business people or the people studying business law and the operations of businesses generally and the lawyers. And I'm curious to know, with Open Innovation and now with this book, what do you see in terms of any trends, positive or negative, in developing that dialogue?
I agree with your point, David, that the discussion really needs to happen. I would also agree with your observation that in the main it's not happening. There is a very active debate on IP policy right now, but that debate, as far as I can tell, has really been driven from the legal side. And the business and management point of view in that debate has been greatly underrepresented. At the same time, a lot of companies are out trying new experiments, and they're actually blazing new territory. And I think, with a few exceptions, the legal community is not well aware of some of these new experiments going on. And so we really do need some scholarship that connects these things much more strongly.
The interdisciplinary is one of those scholarship terms that some people view with scorn. I think more and more people are viewing with admiration. And to a certain degree, what I try to do with Hearsay Culture as someone who's a lawyer and focuses on law is to try to bring people in who are discussing these issues from perspectives that I think the law has to reflect. And in that way, open business models, and I think the segue into your book fits nicely, which is in this work, as you mentioned, and reviewing it over the last few days after reading it when I first got it, I see a heavy focus in this work on the conflict between strong intellectual property rights, or the idea of having intellectual property rights that maintain very strict controls with respect to the intellectual property owner and the ability of people that don't own an intellectual property to use it, and the model of open innovation. And if we think about control and strong controls on one side and sharing, and again, I know I'm using a pedantic term, but I'll use it for purposes of this discussion, sharing on the other, the conflict is quite pronounced. From the perspective of your book and the research that you've done, how can a strong intellectual property regime as currently exists, for the most part, and open innovation be reconciled?
Well, you're right that there is tension there. If IP is so strong that the person holding it becomes effectively a monopolist in an industry where lots of other possible inventions build off of the initial discovery, you can actually foreclose innovation or create monopoly taxes in there. On the other hand, if you have no IP whatsoever, you get very powerful potential sharing of ideas, but there may be no means to capture value in some portion of the business, and that may mean it's hard to sustain initiative going there. So I think the reconciliation comes from having limited but effective intellectual property protection on the one hand, so that there is some ability to capture some value in the process, but not so strong as to completely foreclose innovation in a particular area.
I don't think your book lends itself to this analysis, but I want to give you the opportunity to address it, which is a lot of times when we talk about social sharing in the academic or content creation world, and I'm thinking of books like Yochai Benkler's The Wealth of Networks and others who have recently followed in the footsteps of that work, or when we talk generally about the citizen media and things like that, things that are created by use of copyrighted materials under what I would certainly argue, many others would argue, is fair use. The leap that some people take from that, or from defending or supporting that those forms of creation, is, well, you are opposed to an intellectual property regime across the board. And like I said, I think anyone that reads your book would recognize immediately that there's nothing in your book suggesting that intellectual property rights shouldn't exist. So I want to give you the opportunity to kind of talk a little bit about, if you have any thoughts on it, where you think intellectual property law needs to focus its attention in order to allow for the growth of an open business model.
Yes, I think I would start by in a somewhat different direction, which is I think companies can, and in some cases already are, doing things with intellectual property that really help open things up, even under current law. What I have in mind is using intellectual property in an open way to help create value. And that could be things like creating intellectual commonses through donation of intellectual property, to creating standards bodies and standards processes that help foster the emergence of open, commonly shared information that allows people to coordinate on technical dimensions without having to worry about intellectual property barriers. Many astute companies are realizing that it's very important and indeed necessary to create value before you worry about the problem of how to capture a piece of it. Many companies look at intellectual property only as a means of value capture. I think the more astute, far-sighted companies are thinking of it also as a potential means of value creation. If I may give you one quick example describe what I'm talking about, in the life sciences, Merck has a project they call the Merck Gene Index that Professor Robert Merges at UC Berkeley has written about in the Berkeley Law School. And what he talks about is a story where Merck was worried in the 1990s that a bunch of biotech companies were going to develop and then patent all of these biological markers for various indications that would then allow them to get strong patents on anything having to do with that particular marker, and allow them to essentially control a lot of drug development downstream from that marker.
Mm-hmm.
So what Merck did to organize itself is they said, gee, you know, we're good at making money from drugs once they're in the market, but we don't want people to be able to privatize every individual marker out there.
Mm-hmm.
So they literally created a series of grants to fund research to generate biological markers out of university research organizations, which they then published as part of this Merck Gene Index. And by publishing it, they put it in the public domain, prevented it from being patented, and that allowed Merck to compete with others to commercialize downstream drugs in these areas without being tied up by the upstream biomarkers.
It lends itself, I think, that distinction to what is a theoretical but I think very important question, which is the very purpose of the intellectual property regime. I mean, you talk, and perhaps this is a good time to do it since we're on the topic, but you discuss patent utilization in your book, and in fact with reference I think partially to that example and many others. But you talk about, you know, companies in particular who are utilizing the patents that they own. At one company you point about, I'll let you explain in more detail, 90% of the patents that company held were not being utilized in the market by the company, as I understood it from your book. And the idea of incentivizing is obviously what undergirds the very means or the very structure of intellectual property law, that in the absence of a need to incentivize, there's no need to create limited monopolies in the case of patent or theoretical secrecy for infinite duration in the case of trade secrets, etc., and so forth. When you talk about different ways to utilize intellectual property, at some level, are you running into a question of whether the intellectual property laws themselves are the best vehicle to force those forms of creation and innovation?
Well, let's see. There's a couple of great points in your question. The first point I would make is that companies are engaging in a lot of internal R&D and other innovative activity that generate various forms of intellectual property. But what I show, and I'm not the first one to show this, is that much of that intellectual property, and this is particularly true in the area of patents, is not utilized by the company. So if you will, the social logic of the patent system, which is a grant of a temporary monopoly in return for disclosure of how to do it so that the idea diffuses out to the public after the patent expires, part of the assumption in granting the monopoly is that the company is going to use it. Because if the company doesn't use it, then we have a temporary monopoly that prevents others from making use of it, but they're not able to do that, and the company's not doing that. So we have a long period of time where a discovery or an idea isn't being employed, neither by the company and nor in the society. So there's a lot that it's privately wasteful and socially wasteful. So part of my argument is that companies have private incentives to do more, but they need to change their internal processes so they, in fact, do explore more ways to commercialize unused internal technologies and ideas. And that's why I recommend that companies go through an analysis of patent utilization to see what their own utilization rate is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, I don't mean to argue that the utilization rate should be 100% from the perspective of a business, because there will be cases where you may need patents in reserve for cross-licensing, for other areas of bargaining with other parties if you're trying to coordinate on a set of standards or maybe a patent pool or protect yourself from other infringement lawsuits, etc. But nobody that I've talked to thinks the number should be 10%.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the analysis at a company called Procter & Gamble that did this. And when I've talked informally to other companies, that's in the ballpark of many companies I've spoken to.
Hmm.
Now, to your point about what's the right patent law in this situation, I think the first thing to recognize is that there is no requirement that a person that patents this exercise it, license it, practice it. There's no requirement of any kind for the owner to do anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
And we might want to look at that and say that if you're not going to do anything with it, license whatever, then maybe there ought to be some cost. And I think with the new renewal system, that where you pay renewal fees after, I believe, it's 42 months and 7 years and I believe 10 and a half years in the U.S., and there are different renewal schedules in other countries, renewal rates have an effect of doing this, that if you're not using the patent and you have to renew it and pay more money, many companies, as that renewal date draws closer in, that tends to concentrate the mind, and they say, gee, if we're not doing anything with it, maybe we either ought to let it lapse or sell it or license it, do something else with it. So mm-hmm. I think it does indirectly foster either abandonment on the one hand or greater utilization if you're going to continue to keep it in force. That's probably a good thing from the social perspective.
Yeah, it's what we're incentivizing is always at the core, and you know you're right to make the point that the law doesn't require that usage. I guess, you know, I actually mentioned the 90% statistic to a colleague who's also heavily invested in patent law generally, and the response that this person had was basically, well, that just means the patent system's broken. In other words, why are we even granting patents if a company's only going to use 10%? Do you think that you kind of got to this point, but I want to ask it directly. Do you think those numbers from the standpoint of what of the business model that you're advocating suggest that the system is broken?
I would give a partial yes to that, and I'll explain both the yes and the partial. I think the yes part is that yes, there's too much inefficiency. There's too little utilization of patents in the system. And I think, though, that the good news is I think companies can correct some of this without the help of new law. I think some of this is a matter of new management. But I think where the law comes in is that right now a patent is akin to a lottery ticket
mm-hmm.
or a probabilistic right, which is less than 100% certain. So when a company gets a patent, it's not entirely sure which of its claims will in fact be upheld at a later trial, should that become necessary to enforce it. So mm-hmm. one refinement would be to introduce oppositions, as is done, as I understand it, in the European system, where prior to the actual issuance of a patent, there's a public comment period of, I think, 6 months or so, where others, particularly people who might have a strategic interest in not seeing this granted, can offer up their notions of prior art, so that the patent examiner not only has the results of their own search, but now has the results of the search activities of others who have an interest in perhaps not seeing this issued, so that if you do get a patent through after that process, you've almost been through a miniature version of the discovery process of a trial that might seek to invalidate the patent on the basis of prior art. So if you've survived that, you've probably got a stronger lottery ticket, a higher probability, you're more confident in the asset you actually possess. So it would be a little harder to get the patent, but you're more confident in what it is you have, and that would probably reduce the inefficiencies that particularly, I think, are tough for small companies, that for whom these litigation costs are often prohibitively expensive, and might level the playing field a little bit with some of the larger players.
The world of patent law is one that I've had several guests on, including Mark Lemley and Josh Lerner from Harvard and others. And there is a general consensus, I think, that there definitely needs to be at least a closer look at how the patent process itself plays out and where it leads companies. And I guess before the break, I want to ask you this quick question to kind of close the loop on the patent system, which is in the book you discuss, and I haven't seen a lot written about this area, and I'm glad to see that you discussed it, which is the patent reassignment market in particular. The original owner of a patent actually reassigning the patent to another entity for its own use. And it made me wonder, and I'll leave you with this question. I'll give you an opportunity to answer it briefly, and we'll take a music break. But it led me basically to the thought that the patent system, in many ways, has become an end in itself. That to merely list the patent as an asset of the company without actually using it has a certain value. Do you see the patent system as having in any way become an end game in and of itself?
Let's see. I think I do agree with you that I think the patent reassignment information is breaking new ground and is an area that I think we're going to see a lot more research on going forward. And what's interesting here is not the legal side of reassignments, but is the practice and management of reassignments. So what I'm seeing companies do is they're pledging contingent rights to their intellectual property as a condition of receiving a loan. So it becomes collateral that helps them secure better terms on a loan, for example. And in a sense, if the lender has to foreclose and then obtains these rights to the IP, right now, what are they going to do with it? They don't have a lot to do with it. There's not much recourse for them. But you can imagine in a future world where there are thicker markets for trading these things in the secondary market, that they can then actually get tangible assets for these rights, and that actually means that patents can be created and then they can gravitate toward a higher, better use through secondary markets if things go well. Now, there are other cases where the secondary markets could be used to create blocking positions and foreclose entry and innovation, and that would obviously be much more concerning. This is, I think, the story of the patent troll that gets many people in industry exercised, even though many people in the legal theory don't really have a legal issue with patent trolls. They just see it as a natural consequence of granting monopoly. But I think in the people who are in the business of practicing technologies worry a great deal because it's hard to quantify ex ante what your risk is, and yet you have this ex post potentially long tail of a distribution with a low probability of a highly adverse event. If you get the patents get into the wrong hands, so to speak.
It's a topic that I'm gonna actually take a music break, and when we come back, we'll kind of segue from there into discussing intellectual property rights with respect to university research, which is another topic that you discussed a bit in Open Innovation, but you expand upon throughout Open Business Models. You're listening to KZSU and Hearsay Culture with Professor Henry Chesbrough of UC Berkeley, discussing his new book, Open Business Models. And actually, this show is being recorded on June 4th, but it's going to air on June 6th, just a few days away, and I decided, since this is actually my last week as a resident fellow at Stanford, and therefore my last week where I'm going to have easy access to KZSU's studios, that I would do a musical tribute to my time here. And so actually, if you stay tuned to KZSU after this interview, you will hear an hour of music on Wednesday the 6th from 6 to 7, where I'm going to put on my DJ hat and play some music that I've wanted to play. But Bill Frisell is right up there with the artist that I intend to play in my short hour. Before we continue the conversation with Henry Chesbrough, it is the time on the show where I ask you for money. And those of you that listen to the show regularly hear this constantly and perhaps could recite my words in your sleep. But KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station that relies on listeners' contributions to continue its programming. If you're interested in making a contribution or at least learning more about donating to KZSU, you can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting at kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And otherwise, regardless, I do ask you to keep listening. So we're back with Henry Chesbrough. And Henry, before the break, I was making a segue, which was relatively artful, although it's not easy to do segues on the radio. And I'm going to have to kind of cut short an interesting discussion in patents to talk a little bit in a related area about university patenting. Universities, again, from a theoretical standpoint, were not traditionally avenues of commercialization, but obviously more and more, and it's not anything new, but clearly it's happening at a greater, greater level. Universities are working in tandem with businesses to create marketable technology and invent in ways that focus more on commerce than perhaps they did, you know, 50 or 100 years ago. We discussed a little bit universities patenting and commercializing inventions last time, but throughout your book you talk about these issues, and I guess to revisit it a little bit, but expand upon it. As an educator yourself, do you see the innovation model that's currently being developed, and we can discuss that too, as in any way mutating the the traditional academic research process and the motivations behind academic research?
Yes, I think there is a legitimate concern that universities are shifting their mission focus, and I would say by way of background, the ethos that we have of the university as an institution dedicated to the creation and dissemination of knowledge is a wonderful ideal that I think informs and inspires most of us as educators. The qualification is that society outside of the life sciences is actually cutting back its public support for academic research. And so universities are left with the choice of, if there's less public funding for research, do we just scale back research generally, or do we try to partner with industry and fill in the gap to fund it that way? And I think that's an important condition that's overlooked in much discussion on the topic, because the implicit assumption is that the money is out there and it's plentiful, and universities are simply choosing to take it from business instead of taking it from government. And that's not my experience. My experience is that the government funding is being cut back, and particularly for young researchers trying to get their first grants that allow them to establish their own research trajectory that might lead to promotion and hopefully tenure, the older faculty are really have their arms all over the public money, and to get funding going, they in particular, I think, are stuck having to reach out to industry to get this funding for research that, in my view, would often not otherwise be done. So I think that's the starting point. And we have a situation here at Berkeley you may have heard of, where we have British Petroleum, BP, who's made a grant for $500 million for research on alternative energies here at Berkeley. And so the Berkeley faculty was very concerned about the terms of this and whether this was going to violate academic freedom, whether there was the money was going to have a hidden agenda that was going to corrupt the conduct of the research, and so forth. And there were some additional steps taken at the university to ensure that that did not happen. But that, in my view, was $500 million that otherwise wouldn't be there. And so while it has to be carefully managed and has to be made sure that the priorities and principles of the university aren't violated, hallelujah. Thank heavens for the money that otherwise I don't think would be forthcoming.
You know, and it is, I think, a good point that the practical realities of the operations of academic institutions today do require those partnerships. You know, you mentioned in the book, and I think this would be a good time for it, this entity called UTEK, U-T-E-K, and maybe you could describe for listeners what that organization is and how it fits into your open innovation, open business models theory.
Sure. UTEK is a publicly traded company on the American Stock Exchange. So anybody who wants to learn more about it can go look them up on any website, financial website, to find out their current price and so their financial history, etc. The reason I chose to write about them is that it's a company founded by a professor out of the University of Florida who looked at the way that universities were commercializing technology or were not commercializing technology, and trying to find means to improve that. So just as companies have their own low patent utilization, so too universities have lots of invention disclosures that they either choose not to patent, or if they do patent, they sometimes don't actually get to license them because they don't really know how best to market these inventions and patents. So what this company UTEK does is they actually act as a market maker between university technologies on the one hand and companies that need technology injections on the other hand. And I describe an example of a company in the industrial cleaning business, a smaller company in that space, that needs a new prion-based technology that would allow them to differentiate themselves, tell a much better story to Wall Street and their investors, and in a sense, if they pull it off, get a higher stock price. And the UTEC model is a model where they actually get the license from the university, engage with the company and put it inside the company, take an equity interest in the company, and they make money if and only if the company's stock price rises through their successful incorporation of this new technology.
It's a form of gambling in that sense. And indeed, your book suggests really, I think, in a strong way, pushes businesses to consider this model. Now, from my own perspective, I mean, the main reason I think why I'm particularly interested in your work is really from the standpoint of looking to how we can maximize creation generally for the public good. And I'm not one of those that believes that the commercial markets don't play a big role in that. I mean, commercial research and development is key, and indeed, commercial research and development has been the driving force behind most of the inventions that we, now praise today. And even the creation of the internet, while heavily operated by the government, also had that infusion of private capital. So I'm not opposed to the markets operating in that way. But at the same time, you do paint or point out, I should say, some cautionary notes about how far you can go with open innovation. Now, putting aside the intellectual property issues, you point out, and perhaps you could describe it briefly, but the story of the company called Go, and their efforts to share and how share information for the long-term benefit of establishing a commercial relationship with Microsoft, and how it wound up ultimately, in your estimation, destroying the company. Perhaps you could describe that story and perhaps explain what lessons we should take from the cautionary side from adopting an open business model.
Well, David, you're right to bring this up, because so far our discussion would suggest that open innovation is this wonderful thing and that everybody would be better off if they just adopted it.
Right.
And you could argue that in the case of Go, which was a software company in the early 90s out in Silicon Valley, that they essentially died because they were too open with the wrong people.
Mm-hmm.
The nice thing about this story is that it was recounted by a guy named Jerry Kaplan, who used to be the chief technology officer of Lotus, the people that created 1-2-3 and later on Lotus Notes.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a very savvy, experienced technologist. So he knew what he was doing, and he got funding from Kleiner Perkins and some other really top-tier venture capital firms who also know what they're doing. And yet, Kaplan wrote a book about his experience, a book called Startup, about this whole story I'm about to tell you. So anybody who's interested could actually go in and get the details that I have to summarize rather briefly.
Yeah.
But they created a piece of software that allowed you to use a pen as an input device on a Microsoft Windows computer. And so the idea was you could actually, and they called this operating system Pen Point. And so the idea is you could buy a computer with Pen Point on it, and then use your pen as an input device to do all kinds of things with computers. So they thought at the time that what's going to really make this valuable are applications that take advantage of having a pen as an input device. Gee, who's out there that makes applications? Well, Microsoft was the leading applications developer on the Macintosh, and I think at this time the number two applications developer on the PC. So they said, gee, they're the big gorilla in this space. If we can get them on board, that would really help entice others to come in and really get us going. So they met with Gates personally and one of Gates's technical lieutenants, and Gates spent a whole day with these people arguing with them about why this didn't need to be an operating system, how you could do all of this with Windows.
Mm.
And the Go people were saying, no, actually, Windows doesn't have the facilities it takes to do this. You really need a new operating system to make this go, and you guys ought to make applications for it. And they never did agree on the topic. So Gates goes away. There is some subsequent discussion between the lieutenant and the company, but no deal gets done. Then 6 months later, Microsoft announces Pen Windows.
Hmm.
And it is a Windows version with the ability to take pen input. And the person leading the project was the same lieutenant that was with Gates at these meetings.
Unbelievable.
And so by creating this new pen Windows, the application developers were now, you know, frozen. They didn't know which way to go. Was it going to be pen point? Was it going to be pen Windows? And just the very fact that there was now this choice to be made just slowed down the market for Go tremendously. And in Kaplan's judgment, and I think he's right, it sank the company. So this is a story about being too open to the wrong people. And how do you know they were the wrong people? Well, if you really look at Microsoft's business model, yes, they were an applications developer, but they were also an operating system developer, particularly with DOS and Windows. And Microsoft did not want another operating system in their space. They wanted to leverage the franchise they had built with DOS and Windows. And so if Go had really thought that one through, they might have been able to anticipate this and decide, you know, let's not go talk to Microsoft. Let's go talk to other companies.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a company also in the book after Go called Colabra that was another very small software company that gave me access to all of their non-disclosure agreements back to the founding of the company so I could track who they talked to and when they talked to them. And they did, I think, a much better job of managing selectively who to talk to and when to talk to them. So it's not that small companies can't succeed in open innovation, but small companies have to be careful who they talk to when they do these things.
Ultimately, you know, it, again, I mean, it gets back to this gambling or a question of risk aversion. And I guess I'd ask you, I mean, is there, without being specific to a particular company, would you say that there are any entities or companies or company structures, again, without getting terribly specific, that do not or should not ever consider an open business model? In other words, the situation with Go describes a scenario, as you set it out, where the company chose the wrong entity to talk to and perhaps revealed the wrong information or too much. But can you conceive of a type of company where the open business model would simply be too high a risk?
Yes, good question, and yes, I can. I would say some of the litmus tests one should run through are how much useful information is out there externally that we need. There may be areas in industry where there's not a lot of information coming from universities or from startups, and in fact most of it's coming from yourself or your main competitors. The nuclear power industry comes to mind as an example, or aircraft engines, if you will, would be another one, where these are highly complex systems. They're very, very capital intensive. No venture capitalist is going to back a company in this space. Universities don't have the resources or, frankly, the interest to invest in technologies in these areas. So these are areas where you'd probably want to remain pretty closed.
Mm-hmm.
Even IBM, who I celebrate as a somebody who's learned new tricks as an open innovator when they used to be very closed, if you look at their mainframe computer business, it looks a lot like it did used to look, and it's still very inwardly focused, very vertically integrated, not particularly open. So even a company like IBM, which is very open in areas like software, remains very closed in areas like mainframe computing.
Mm-hmm. It does leave me, and we only have a couple of minutes left, unfortunately. And you know, I invited you back once before. I extend the invitations. I mean, I can't quite make it the Henry Chesbrough show as much as I would like to continue the conversation over several shows, but I certainly want to invite you back in advance to continue the conversation, especially really to take a look at how your theory is applied and what the impact of the book is. Because in my estimation, your particular model and the ideas that you're putting forth, as I mentioned in the introduction, I think are critical. And I think it's particularly important that policymakers be aware of research that you're doing because, like, you know, as I said in the introduction, in many ways this seems counterintuitive. And yet in your book, you point to a number of examples of major companies and smaller companies that have used this model successfully while noting, as you just did, the caution of that there is a limit to it. But I guess I'll ask you the crystal ball question in closing, which is, where do you see 5 years from now the open business model having its most currency, and conversely, where do you see it facing its biggest obstacles?
Let's see. I think one area where I think we will see more, I think you will see closer and closer interaction between intellectual property management in companies and their innovation processes. Today, in many companies, these are very separately managed. I think you're going to see more and more connection and integration between those functions. And indeed, I'm beginning to see that in a few companies already. A second thing I think you're going to see is more intermediate markets between invention and innovation. If invention being the discovery of new ideas and technologies and innovation being the commercialization of those in the market, I think we're going to see thicker markets between those two steps, and that's going to have a lot of implications for intellectual property, but also for our ability as a society to get more use out of the ideas that we create.
Mm-hmm.
So those are, I think, some things where it's going. Some barriers I think they're going to turn up. We are going to have to address the patent system, and we're going to have to find ways to create clarity. I would say even more important than the strength of the patent is the clarity of the patent, what it covers, what it doesn't cover. We need to do a better job, I think, socially in being very clear with patent holders what it is they've got and what they don't have, and not make them have to go through a very expensive trial before they find that out. So I think those are some areas where I see challenges. Another thing I think will be interesting is this whole WIPO process of trying to harmonize patent regimes across different countries. Innovation has become a truly global activity, and IP remains very nationally bounded. And so there's going to be very interesting friction points when you look at different rules in different countries on the legal side, while you've got these global supply chains and global innovation chains operating in parallel on the business side.
Is the, I guess in the last minute, I said it was the last question, but I guess I feel compelled to ask this follow-up, which is quickly in the international sphere, how much currency do you see the open business model taking in countries like Europe, or countries like Europe, in places like Europe, or in countries like Japan or others that have had very different views of intellectual property generally?
Excellent point. One thing I can report is that there are now academic centers for open innovation in Switzerland at the University of St. Gallen, and also in Holland and Belgium, a center at the University of Leuven in Belgium and the University of Eindhoven in the Netherlands. I'm seeing academic institutions funded by the government setting up to study open innovation more generally and its implications for innovation policy, not so much patent policy, but innovation policy. In Asia, it's at an earlier stage. I think Japan is showing more interest in this topic, but interestingly, their resurgence there has come largely from the big companies, not from the startups. And so the Japanese system has some very interesting attributes that work differently than, let's say, the Silicon Valley model. And so their intellectual property and innovation policies, I think, are going to be developed in a different context than the one that we've been discussing so far.
Henry, unfortunately, we're going to have to end the discussion there. I want to thank you for returning to Hearsay Culture to discuss your book, Open Business Models, How to Thrive in a New Innovation Landscape. I thank you for writing a book, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future and following your research and hopefully maybe doing a little writing in a tangential area in the near future. But for the time being, thank you so much for joining me today on the show.
David, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure to be back.
Same here. I want to thank Henry Chesbrough again for being on the show today. This show is being recorded, as I mentioned, on June 4th and being aired June 6th. The show is then going to take a two-week hiatus. And then starting in late June, there will be a number of shows aired that I'm recording. Both I recorded this past week and will be recording this week. And all of these interviews, I think you will enjoy and hopefully learn from, and hopefully it will stimulate thought. I encourage you to, as always, reach out to me with any comments or questions or suggestions or what have you. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you have the opportunity to hear the show in podcast form, that is sadly without the music, by going to the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Or you can also go to the CIS webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And finally, you can always find the schedule and all the shows and my blog posts and A lot of other information by going to hearsayculture.com. Normally also, I'd say, now stay tuned for X, but X today is me. I decided to take an extra hour from 6 to 7 on Wednesday to kind of do my DJ thing before I head east to North Carolina. So I'll ask you simply to stay tuned to hear me as a DJ for whatever that's worth to you. Hopefully you'll find it enjoyable. But otherwise, to thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture. I hope you enjoy your two-week break. For those of you that are setting your watches and clocks and alarms around the show. But I will look forward to continuing discussion with you 2 weeks from now. But for now, just stay tuned, and you're going to hear Dave the DJ. So thank you for listening today, and I will be back in a little while.